I've mentioned before on this program, one of my favorite movies is Network, Paddy Chayefsky's criticism of the TV industry. And there's a scene in there where Ned Beatty's CEO character chews out the mad prophet Howard Beale. One of the listeners sent me the text of that speech he delivers, in which he says, "There are no nations, there are no peoples, there are no Russians, there are no Arabs, there are no third worlds. There's only one holistic system of systems, one vast, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichmarks, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It's the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today. That is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today. And you, Mr. Beale, have meddled with the primal forces of nature." And Joseph P. Farrell, our guest tonight, is also meddling with the primal forces of nature, describing the world as it is and the influence of Babylon's banksters. We'll jump into such subjects as the Federal Reserve and suppressed technology right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Joseph Farrell about Babylon's banksters. You know them, Joe. You love them. It's the Federal Reserve. And I'll tell you, I'm ashamed to admit this, but I really don't understand how it fits in. You know, you think of it for years as part of the government somehow, something right. That is in the government, controlled by the government. The president can tell them what to do, or Congress or whatever. And really, that is not the case.
No, it isn't. And, you know, it was very, very clever when the banksters set that up, that they chose the word federal, because essentially what they were doing was hiding behind that name and making it seem like it's an instrumentality of government. But the only part that government really plays in it is the presidential appointment of the director or the chairman of the Federal Reserve. But beyond that, it's a privately held joint stock company. So there's really, you know, it's no more federal than Federal Express.
So you look at somebody like Bernanke and you know, I would imagine for him, it's like riding a Brahma bull or something. You don't exactly know where this thing is going to go. You might be the guy who's the titular head of the thing. It doesn't mean you control it.
That's right. Exactly so. And, you know, the irony of it all, George, is that during this last big, you know, billions of dollars bailout that began under the Bush administration and has continued under this administration, really what we're doing is borrowing money from the Federal Reserve to bail out the very banksters that are loaning the money to bail them out. So, you
who
know,
caused it. Yeah, the guys who caused
exactly.
it. You know, it's almost like, well, before we leave the Federal Reserve, I mean, how would you, what level of control does, say, the president have over them in appointing that top guy versus the level of control that the banks might have? I mean, who do they take their marching orders from?
Well, I that's another excellent question. And my opinion would be that the president really has very, very little control over who gets appointed. Certainly, the corporate influence in presidential campaigns to begin with is very, very pronounced. So by the time anyone gets in office, they're going to be more or less told or given a short list of candidates from which to choose. But, you know, that's more or less like voting in the old Soviet Union. You know, you can choose candidate A or candidate B, but they're going to be from the same party.
Yeah, you can choose from Goldman Sachs or,
right.
You know, Merrill Lynch.
That's right.
Well, what is the FDI, the Federal Reserve's agenda then?
Well, personally, I think at one time it was genuinely to gain control of the American economy by any means necessary, but largely through the instrumentality of the creation of massive amounts of debt. Because, of course, there's never enough principal in circulation to pay off debt. Our debt is proceeding apace at the miracle of compound interest, while the principal just kind of lurches along at the slow growth of arithmetical growth. So in other words, that interest cannot be repaid on the principal in circulation. But now I think the game has really changed, because if the scenario of economic warfare and David Lee's formula is true, and I think there's a great deal arguing in favor of that scenario, then again, that corporate elite is now on the defensive. They've made too many enemies around the world. And the other thing that they're faced with now is China's very active role into going into third world countries and building up their infrastructure, roads and hospitals and schools and things like that. They're doing that with a vengeance in Africa, and they're doing it with a vengeance along with the Russians in Latin America. So they are really losing their worldwide grip. Their only base of power that they really have the similar amount of control over that they've had in past decades is North America.
Well, you hate to root for the Russians or root for the Chinese if you think about America as a government entity of the people. But you're saying that the America that we know really isn't by the Americans. It's somebody else.
Yes, it's rule of Wall Street by Wall Street and for Wall Street. I don't think it can be put any more concisely than that. I think if we're to get our republic back, we really have to start listening to the politicians with the guts, like Ron Paul and a few others that have stood up and said, we really need to go in and audit this thing called the Federal Reserve. And if we find malfeasance, then go after the people that have practiced it.
All right. Well, let's talk about reform for a couple of minutes. And as a way to get into it, let's begin with the bailout. Your thoughts on this bailout? I mean, you know, a lot of finger pointing in this, a lot of partisan heat. Finger pointing by Democrats versus Republicans, who's to blame for the mess, who allowed it to happen. Mm-hmm. And yet, when it comes to the bailout, it's bipartisan. Bush starts it, Obama continues it, everybody's happy to go along.
Yes. Well, again, I think my personal thought about the bailout, and I'm glad you asked that question, is that I had the impression, George, when I was watching those initial hearings back in the tail end days of the Bush administration, that we were looking at people who were acting like they were trying to pay off a hidden blackmailer, because there was this business that they wanted of no oversight of where this money was going to go. We were just supposed to hand them a blank check, and they were going to spend it as they wished. And to me, that smacks of the behavior of people that are under some sort of hidden pressure. I don't know from where. I have my suspicions, and my suspicions go back to the end of World War II and the post-war founding of the Bilderberg Group, because what I think the purpose of that group was for was to take all that Nazi loot and make it available to the big Western banks in New York City and London and launder that money. But any time you're sitting down with the likes of some sort of post-war international Nazi organization with a lot of loot, that's going to come with a heavy marker to pay off. And when that marker comes due, you'd better be able to pay. And I think something like that probably happened when the collapse came and the money was demanded, because the behavior of those bankers was to me far too suspicious and far too nervous. They were too nervous in asking for this no oversight clause.
You know, I hate to insult drunken sailors everywhere, but it's like Wall Street was acting like worse than any drunken sailor you could imagine. I mean, brought this on themselves, risking all kinds of money, gambling, betting against their clients, things of that sort. And then, you know, they come hat in hand, bail us out, we're too big to fail. What do you make of that whole we're too big to fail scenario? Would things be worse if we hadn't bailed them out?
No, I don't think so. They aren't too big to fail. You know, the problem is that we have followed or really been suckered into believing that, you know, what's good for corporate America is good for all of us. Well, corporate America has shifted our manufacturing base largely overseas and done so under the aegis or the name of these goofy free trade agreements. When America was prosperous, we had relatively heavy protective tariffs on our industry, and that's when that industry grew and our trade grew proportionally. Now, we are a debtor nation. We carry on a negative balance of trade with most nations, especially with China, because they're actually producing things. So I think too big to fail is absolutely untrue. If anything, they are too big not to be audited and not to be closely regulated by honest government.
What do you make of corporations, and again, they're American-based corporations, who send billions, tens of billions to these offshore banks strictly as a tax dodge? And our government still does business with these companies.
Well, again, I think that that's a practice that has to be stopped. I mean, they are they are literally plundering the country, and it's high time, you know, to call a halt to this laissez-faire free trade idea and start bringing some of that money back home and bringing some of the industry back home with it. And that can only be done, in my opinion, by restructuring some of the policies of the government. We've got to make industry something that is profitable to do here. And in my opinion, again, the historical record is fairly clear. That can only be done by means of some sort of tariff.
Well, let's start with the idea of regulation or reform or getting this thing under control. This past weekend, yesterday, I guess, the Senate passed its version of financial reform.
Right.
I can guess how you feel about it, but why don't you go ahead and tell me?
Well, I haven't been following that very closely, but anything in that bill, as far as I'm concerned, and this is kind of a matter of general political philosophy for me, anytime a politician, be it Democrat or Republican, stands up and calls for financial reform and they do not address the basic fundamental issue of how the nation's money is issued and who is issuing it, then any sort of reform that they're talking really doesn't go to the nub of the problem. The nub of the problem is now, as it has been for millennia, whether or not the state is going to issue debt-free money or whether they're going to turn over that aspect of state sovereignty to a private monopoly that can only issue monetized debt. That's the rub of the problem. And on that score, I think Ron Paul is absolutely right. We've got to look at the Federal Reserve and look at it very closely.
All right, let's theorize. Let's say Congress somehow finds the cojones to pass a bill that says let's audit the Federal Reserve. What do you think they'd find?
Well, in my opinion, if they don't do it right, they're going to find precious little, because those banksters that own the Federal Reserve are going to make sure that the records are either missing or doctored. So essentially what we're going to have to do is pull something very similar to what King Philippe le Bel in France did in the 14th century when he shut down the Templars. He basically raided all the Templar lodges at the same time in a pre-coordinated action. But they're going to have to do something like that, in my opinion, with the Federal Reserve if they're going to really get the records. But they could conceivably pass a law to audit the Federal Reserve that if there were no records, then that would be an indicator of culpability of some sort and prosecute them under the RICO Act.
Okay, audit the Federal Reserve. What else? How far do you go?
Well, in my opinion, we have to go to the policy, again, of state-issued money. But I don't think this is something that could be done all at once or overnight. In other words, I do credit to a certain extent the idea that some of these banks are so large that they're going to have to be broken up, number one, and put under a lot more regulation, number two. And we're going to gradually have to take out, kind of do a reverse play of the scenario that the banksters themselves have used. We're going to have to allow a certain amount of their debt notes to remain in circulation and remove them from circulation gradually.
Tell me what your assessment of whether there is really an appetite in Washington for this kind of reform. You mentioned about Ron Paul. Is he sort of wandering alone in the wilderness there, or
no,
would you anticipate he'd have support?
No, actually, I was just informed that the socialist senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, managed to get an audit of the Federal Reserve passed in the current Senate version of the bill. And, you know, kudos to him. I don't care if he's a socialist or not. It's high time that something like that be done.
And so if in fact, what you've been describing in this program, where bankers assassinate presidents, manipulate media, control academia, it would seem to me that they would resist that kind of thing. I mean, you know, it doesn't seem like anything important gets done in Washington anymore. And I'm sad to say that I don't have faith something like this could get done.
Well, I'm kind of in the same boat by nature with you, George, but there is some good news because Ron Paul managed to get the audit of the Federal Reserve passed in the House version of the bill. So in other words, that's going to go to conference. So again, my point is that the banksters are on defensive. They are not only on defensive internationally, they're on defensive domestically. So I do think that in the long term, we are looking at good things. We've just got to be patient. We've got to support those politicians calling for these things, regardless of what their political party might be, and get this done.
I want to speak for a couple of minutes about suppression of technology. Sure. It's a topic that's been discussed on this program many times. You've written about it. You talked about some exotic technologies that the Nazis had and that sort of vanished into the ether. You know, you look at things like the electric car or cars that can get 100 miles to the gallon. You figure, the oil companies are thwarting that.
Yes.
Is it them or is it bankers?
Well, it's both, actually. You know, the most famous example of this suppression of technology goes back to Nikola Tesla, and I spend a great deal of time talking about this in the book, because what it does, what that particular example does, is it exposes the mentality and the thinking of these banksters. Tesla was, of course, going to build a project on Long Island. He actually started it, to beam electrical power anywhere to the globe with very little loss of energy. And he had actually demonstrated that technology in his famous Colorado Springs experiments and then talked J.P. Morgan into funding this effort. But what happened was that Morgan, once he learned that Tesla was not just going to be sending radio out with this project, but actual electrical power, he pulled the plug on the project and gave the famous statement, well, if this is the case, it's going to be impossible for me to meter it. But if you look at Morgan's actions closely and carefully in that particular episode, Morgan really is acting against his own financial interest, because he stood to make a pile of money off of the royalty and licensing agreements that would have come from Tesla's equipment. So the question really becomes is, why does he pull the plug on that project? And the answer, I think, is in some New York Times articles that Tesla ran beginning in 1908, when he began to talk about the weaponization potential of that technology. And he pointed out in these articles that you could quite literally devastate a whole region of the globe by using this technology in a weaponized form, or if a particular region or country proved non-compliant, you could simply withdraw their electrical power. You could simply quit beaming it to them. Now, if you put yourself in the bankster's position with a technology like that, they've really got two motivations for suppressing it. The first is, number one, they want to monopolize that technology for themselves and secretly develop it. But the other reason is a kind of an altruistic reason, because if you're dealing with this kind of technology, George, you're dealing with something relatively easy to engineer. I mean, my word, any electrical engineer worth his salt could put together Tesla's patents and reconstruct this stuff. So what they're doing is, in a certain sense, they're trying to keep this technology from falling into the wrong hands. Third world nut dictators and so on and so forth that could literally hold the world hostage to it. And I think, you know, to give credit where credit is due, I don't think these bankers are terribly nice people. But on the other hand, this is certainly a motivating factor in why they suppress some of this technology. They simply don't want it falling outside of their monopoly, and they don't want it falling into the wrong hands that could hold everybody hostage.
Yeah, some of it might be self-preservation and for them and the rest of us, but a lot of it might just be defending their economic position, cars that,
That's exactly so. It would change the paradigm so completely, because if you have access to this technology, you have essentially access to inexhaustible energy, and that breaks their power.
Well, a lot of people talk about that, and I know you don't really want to get into the UFO field, but a lot of discussion about that as being a reason for suppressing UFO information, if there are hints about future energy technologies from that arena.
Oh, yes, and that's definitely a valid take, and I think if you look at some of the research that Stephen Greer has done, this is certainly something that emerges in those affidavits, absolutely.
And is zero-point energy what you're talking about?
Yes, essentially that's right. It's zero-point energy, or if you prefer, energy from the vacuum.
And you believe that technology is harnessable?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I not only believe it's harnessable, I think it has actually been done.
All right. We're talking with Joseph Farrell. Babylon's Banksters is his new book, and we'll come back with more of that. Tom Petty Breakdown taking us into our break. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Joseph Farrell about Babylon's Banksters, and we've sort of skipped one major part of the discussion, and that's what he calls econophysics. It delves into things like quantum tunneling, outer space, even ties in astrology. And when we come back, we'll jump into that. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. My guest is Joseph Farrell. Dr. Farrell, could I put you in the category with Jesus and the money changers? You want to kick over the table?
Well, basically, yeah, that would be an apt analogy.
But I mean, it is an appropriate analogy, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think so. Because I think he's taking direct aim when he does that in the Gospels at this alliance between the money changers and the temple. And you know, that ties right into the whole theme of econophysics, because that's essentially what we're dealing with in ancient times.
Well, I wonder if we could point to the banksters as being behind what happened to Christ.
That's a very strong possibility, you know, the 30 pieces of silver.
You mentioned in your book, Babylon's Banksters, a connection to astrology. How does that fit?
Well, that to me is one of the most interesting things I ran into at both ends of the spectrum, the ancient one and the modern one. In the ancient one, of course, many of those ancient temples were directly tied with astrological activity. That's certainly true in Mesopotamia. It's certainly true in Egypt, and it's certainly true of the money making activity that's associated with those temples. So you have it there. And in ancient times, I think it's very important to remember what the Babylonian records actually say about the basis of astrology. And that is that those observations spanned several thousand years. Now, the standard response of most academics is, you know, well, that's just fiction, it's not true, and so on and so forth. I'm one of those that believes that you really cannot explain the sudden rise of Egypt and the sudden rise of Sumer as fully fledged civilizations without having some precursor civilization behind them. And if we take their own records seriously, that in fact that was the case, that they're legacies of something else, then we have to admit the possibility then that astrology at one time had a much more scientific basis. And the reason I say that is if we come to modern times, one of the things that I researched, George, in the book was a foundation called the Foundation for the Study of Cycles. It's not very well known, but it accumulated a massive amount of data on all sorts of cycles in all sorts of areas of human activity, economics, emotions, weather, you know, trade, and so on and so forth. And the foundation was actually started by a man named Edwin Dewey, who was Hoover's economist that he appointed to study the reasons for the Great Depression. It's probably the only positive legacy that President Hoover left us. But as a result of this, there was created a huge database. And one of the things that I found extremely interesting, George, was Dewey himself had a view of these cycles as being correlated to each other. In a certain sense, he was almost talking the same language as David Lee, this Chinese mathematician we talked about earlier, but with one important difference. Dewey understood that this was historical data, and he also understood that it had a physics basis. And that, in turn, leads into this whole field of what I call econophysics, and that's actually a technical term. I didn't invent it. It's actually a term that others have used for what's going on. Because during the 80s and so on, you had a vast amount of graduates in physics that took their talents in applied mathematics that they use in physics, and they went to work for banks, and they went to work modeling economic activity on the basis of physics models that they were using in physics. So there's another little connection to connect the dots together.
And it works.
Oh, yes, absolutely it works. Absolutely it works. The thing that I found most interesting, George, is that if you look at the four major American depressions, the one that occurred after the Revolutionary War, the one that occurred after the Civil War, and another one in the 1890s, and then, of course, the Great Depression. Oddly enough, there is a physics, because if you look at the astrological charts for the United States during those periods of time, you find the planets, the major planets, in an astrological formation called the Grand Cross. So yeah, there's even an astrological and physical correlation with depression there. Now, my point with all of this and raising all of this is that if you are a banker, if you have access to that vast database in the Foundation for the Study of Cycles database, if you have access to that kind of astrological information, then you won't necessarily be able, by your financial activity, to upset the cycle, but you can certainly exacerbate the trend that the cycle is on. And that's why this whole formula by David Lee seems so interesting to me, because the bubble burst precisely at the time that the cycle was predicted to take a downturn. It's almost as if it had been deliberately orchestrated to do that.
I want to, before we get too far away from this, you mentioned that you felt that the Babylonians and Sumerians had some sort of a precursor civilization. Who's that?
Pardon me now? Say that again?
The Babylonians, Sumerians, there must have been some sort of a precursor civilization. Who might that be?
Well, that's a good question. If you go back to the ancient records, and this really opens up a can of worms that I really don't get into in Babylon's Banksters, but if you go back to ancient Akkadian cuneiform records, that group is definitely a group of people that come to this planet. In other words, they're not native to this planet. And they arrive here a long, long time ago and begin all sorts of tinkering with humanity. And that includes, as far as I'm concerned, in the book I'm researching now, that would include a certain amount of financial activity and maneuvering behind the scenes.
Wow. So
you're
talking about alien intervention here.
Yeah, sort of. I would have to qualify alien here in the sense that I think we're dealing in this group of people with something, so to speak, that would be our genetic cousins. In other words, they are directly genetically related somehow to humanity. They're not little grays. They're not reptiles or any of this stuff. They're humanoid or human-looking in appearance.
And those kinds of people, beings, appear throughout the Bible?
Yeah, the reference to the Nephilim in Genesis chapter 6, I think, is part of this. But if you go back to the Akkadian and Sumerian tablets, they're called the Anunnaki. And, of course, you know, Sitchin has written about those, and others have written about those people. But essentially what you're dealing with there is somehow a group or a species or a genus, if you will, on the phylogenetic tree that is related to humanity.
Well, I can see why you wouldn't want to get into that with economists or maybe physicists. And can you talk to economists and physicists about this general concept? And if so, how do they take it?
Well, most of them know. I mean, most of them are still thinking inside the box, so they'd look at all of this as being kind of a pseudoscience. There are very, very few that are willing to look outside the box that you could talk to about the relationship between this kind of financial policy and this kind of physics. Paul Laviolette would certainly be one of them. You've had him on your show, and Tom Bearden would be another. People of that sort that have been thinking outside the box for any number of years. But no, for the most part, you're not going to be able to talk about any of these theories with anybody connected with academia or any of these big corporate foundations.
Well, that's why you're here on Coast to Coast.
Yes.
We can talk about it all night.
That's right.
A term that you use in the book is quantum tunneling, and I'm trying to figure out how that fits into econophysics.
Well, quantum tunneling, just to be very brief, is the idea that if you pulse something, the pulse will emerge on the other side of it. And there is a phenomenon, even in DNA, where you can take a certain packet of energy or quantum, as physicists call it, and it will actually tunnel through particular barriers oftentimes at faster than light speed. So this is really a phenomenon of information transfer, and that's kind of how I relate it to this whole idea of econophysics, particularly in ancient times. Because if we're going to assume the existence of an international elite, an economic elite in ancient times, they have to have some mechanism or some method of being able to transmit their signals, to coordinate their activity, and do so rather quickly. And this is one of the most astounding things I found when I was researching Babylon's banksters, and that is the work of a German engineer. His name is Dr. Constantine Mile. And he looks at ancient temples with an engineer's eye and basically comes to the conclusion that they're some sort of primitive radio transmitter. And I outline all that case in Babylon's banksters. So, again, you have this alliance of sophisticated technology. You have that allied with the temple, and then in turn the temple allied with the activity of this economic class. So you're looking at the same pattern in ancient times as you're looking at in modern times.
So we were sort of joking about the secret handshake. Maybe this is what they have instead.
That's exactly right.
Is there, and I don't know if this fits, but when you think about Ark of the Covenant, secret technologies, ancient wisdom, things of that sort, and that giant warehouse at the end of the Indiana Jones movie, controlled by whomever, I guess banksters would be in on that. Is there something like that, you think, somewhere?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Again, I think we have to look at the suppression of this technology, particularly in modern times, as an activity that is more or less the activity both of governments and of a corporate elite, because they are wanting to monopolize this technology for themselves, number one, and they're also wanting to keep it out of the hands of you know, third world crazies that would hold the world hostage. And so there's your government role. So absolutely.
The last time I had you on the program, it was to talk about the Brotherhood of the Bell.
Right.
And I want to touch on that last couple of minutes in this segment and see if there's an update. First of all, could you refresh the audience's memory about what the Brotherhood of the Bell referred to, what the Nazi Bell was?
Well, the Bell was the Third Reich's most highly classified secret weapons project. It was given the classification of Kriegsentscheidend, or War Decisive. And what it was in a nutshell, a project I think that the Nazis had designed to do three things, or give them the gateway technology to three things. The first was, of course, to able to manipulate the zero-point energy. The second thing they wanted with it was an advanced field propulsion. And then the third thing they wanted was, of course, a doomsday weapon, Nazis being Nazis. Now, the Brotherhood of the Bell is kind of my name for what I believe essentially becomes the post-war Nazi international, a kind of a post-war extraterritorial Nazi state. And the reason I call it the Brotherhood of the Bell is, in my opinion, in my research that I've done subsequent to that book, I've come to the conclusion that there is very strong evidence, George, that they continued independently of any of the victorious Allied powers of World War II to research that physics and that project privately and independently after the war. And they did so in Argentina. I even pinpoint more or less the location in Argentina that they did this. So it's my name, really, for this cabal, this coterie of post-war international fascists that are researching all of this type of technology that we've been talking about tonight.
Well, since the book came out, what's the update? Anything? Anybody come forward to give you new information? Hey, I worked on that thing?
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
I published a book called The Nazi International, in which I detail this post-war project, and then I get into a little bit of it in Roswell and the Reich as well. But basically, I was approached kind of by an intermediary that represented a veterans group, let's just put it that way, in Latin America, okay? They gave some interesting information and even some pictures of the remains of this Nazi project down in Argentina. So, yes, there's definitely been some contact.
And is the implication of that being that the technology was taken down to Argentina or South America with the escaped Nazis?
Yes, that's my current position. The Bell Project, I do not think, fell into American hands or into Soviet hands or British hands or anybody else. I think the project went to Argentina. It was continued under the auspices of Juan Perón's government, but he inadvertently spilled the beans on the project in a public press conference. And as a result of that, the hidden Nazi masters had the Nazi scientist that was heading this thing up, act like an absolute fool and incompetent for the Argentine commissioners that came to examine the project, and thus Perón shut it down, enabling them to move the project elsewhere. And the reason I think that it was moved elsewhere was that 4 years after the project was shut down, the American Air Force is still secretly interviewing this Nazi scientist in hopes to learn a little bit more about what the project was and possibly where it went, and they never learned. So I think the Nazis simply moved it elsewhere in Latin America.
Close the circle, is there a connection between that technology, between the remnants or progeny of Nazis who escaped and lived down there, mm-hmm. and the banksters?
Yes, I think there is a very direct connection. And let me give you an anecdotal story. There was a book that was published by a former associate of Ed Murrow at CBS. The man's name was Paul Manning. And he published a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And in it, he essentially documented that Martin Bormann, if you allow the records of the Argentine Central Intelligence into consideration, those records are very clear that he lived for a rather long time in Argentina after the war, coordinating all these Nazi activities. But the most interesting thing that he says in the book to me is that circa 1967, when Bormann was already a very old man, he actually cashed a check for several million dollars drawn on Chase Manhattan and Manufacturers Hanover Trust in New York City, and the check was cleared in Deutsche Bank in Buenos Aires, and the check was written over his own signature.
Wow.
So there's your coordination and connection between this post-war Nazi international and the bankers.
Would you think some of these guys are on Wall Street, are in brokerage houses?
I wouldn't be surprised. Not at all. I wouldn't be surprised because it would fit the pattern of the post-war Nazi penetration into so many sensitive areas of American industry and American commerce. It would fit the pattern exactly.
Is there a connection between the Nazi Bell and what we generally refer to as the Philadelphia Experiment? Were Americans trying to master that same technology?
There is, yes. There is, in my opinion, a very direct connection between the two experiments because they come out of one and the same physics. They come out of the same physics papers that appeared between the wars, and more importantly, they come out of the same engineering papers that appeared between the wars. The only difference between the two, George, is, in my opinion, I don't think that the American scientists were looking for some of the effects that they actually found, whereas I think the Nazis had rationalized things a little bit more thoroughly and were looking for some of these things. But in all other respects, yes, the physics is the same.
And any guess on who controls that technology or where they stashed it or what they're doing with it?
Well, when I researched the Philadelphia experiment, I published a book on that called Secrets of the Unified Field. And to my surprise, I found out that the records for the experiment were actually recovered by somebody from the Coast Guard. So you talk about a place, an interesting place to hide an experiment like that. It would be the last place that anybody would expect to look. Unfortunately, there's no records to be had. After all those records disappeared from the Navy archives, they went to the Coast Guard, and all trace of them has been lost. I would suspect that that whole thing has disappeared again into the black bowels of American black projects and corporate defense contractors.
Back into the warehouse.
Back into the warehouse.
We got a minute or two left here. I want to bring it full circle and get some predictions from you. You told us what you hope happens in terms of regulating and auditing the banksters. What do you think will happen? What's your prediction?
Well, I think in the long term we're going to be okay. I don't think for a moment that there's not going to be some bumps along the road. But I think really, George, in the bottom line is that there are too many people now that are angry at this particular class of people. I think that the information now is getting out there to too many hands, too many people are thinking about it. So to me, in the long term, that spells nothing but good. I think we're going to have some bumps in the road during the short term, but I think in the long term, we're looking at good things.
You know, I saw those guys before Congress, before that Senate committee, the Fabulous Fab or whatever that guy's name was, and the emails that came out, and they just seemed so cocky. And
yes,
And just it didn't seem to have sunk in that what they were facing there, or certainly any sense of responsibility. But we'll get into that when we come back. Talking with Joseph Farrell, author of Babylon's Banksters, and we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions right after this. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.